Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Simplified podcast. I am your co-host, Chris Seveny. Today, we have a special guest. We have Amy Silvis with Silvis Capital. Amy, how are you today?
I'm amazing, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
Good. Pre-recording, we were just talking. Amy's on the West Coast and talking about how they're finally seeing sunshine for a while. And for us who listeners on the East Coast, I know we feel very sad that the West Coasters had to go a little while without that wonderful sunshine that we, I think, seen the sun for the first time in a month the other day. But thank you for joining us. Amy's a real estate investor in large commercial properties across the U.S., has some flex industrial, and like I said, some apartment units, and has about $100 million under management. And we're going to talk today about mindset in that journey from a passive to investor or active investor. But as we get going, Amy, why don't you give us a little intro about what you got going on right now with your business?
Sure. Thank you again so much for having me. It is an interesting time, right? It is St. Patrick's Day, so March 17th, 2023. And wow, the Fed has hiked interest rates at the fastest pace in history. And it's definitely slowed down business a little bit, made us a little bit more choosy, but we're still very bullish on the fundamentals of both multifamily and flex industrial real estate. So we're still actively sourcing deals and getting those great opportunities for ourselves and our investors. And it's still a very exciting time, at least in my book.
So are you buying, I'll say, assets that are already basically stabilized, or are you buying assets that are kind of new construction? What type of asset are you looking at today?
Yeah, we typically do class A and B, 1980s or newer multifamily, similar in the flex industrial space as well. The multifamily side, we buy value add. So maybe think of units that haven't been updated or refreshed in several decades, but in markets where tenants' income is growing, jobs are growing, and they're really demanding nicer units. That's usually our business plan there. And then in the flex industrial space, we're very focused on markets where onshoring is happening, manufacturing returning back to the US, and yeah, value add opportunity in terms of being able to put tenants in place in these multi-tenant industrial flex complexes where we can do a value add play there by raising our net operating income.
So you mentioned it's St. Patrick's Day today, and a lot has happened over the past week in the markets and in the banks and what's going on in the world. Oh, yeah. As somebody active in this space, how are you preparing or anticipating, or what are some of the things you're seeing that might not, real estate does take a little while for things, not like the market where it can go down 400 points a day. Right. Real estate's a little lengthier process before it gets traction. What are some of the things that you're anticipating today that might not have been thinking about 3 months or a year ago?
Yeah, you know what? I think just like most people, we're looking to see where the Fed is going to go. I think we weren't quite sure how soon the impact of these rising rates were going to have on the economy. Next week, the FOMC meeting is occurring and we will see if the Fed decides to pause raising rates, if they may raise a little bit, maybe at a slower pace. We are planning on the Fed continuing to raise rates, even though basically as the most conservative policy possible for us to really think that might happen and underwrite and source deals, assuming that. So they may not, they may decide to hold, and that'll be better for our business because usually the cost of capital will either hold steady or go down in terms of debt. But yeah, it's a very interesting time, but as you mentioned, there are many ways we can mitigate risk and poise ourselves to take advantage no matter what the Fed decides to do.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And before we talk a little bit more about that, let's rewind it a little bit and talk about actually how you got involved in real estate and how you've grown your company to, I'm guessing, starting at zero up to a $100 million company. I'm excited to hear that. And we love hearing these types of stories. That's everybody would, I'm sure, love to get there that is active in this space.
Absolutely. Gosh, yeah. Let me know how detailed you want me to get. But essentially, I started off as a passive investor in the space with an eye towards being an active investor. So I wanted to get that education and experience before I decided to scale. So I ended up passively investing actually for a little bit longer than I thought. I did it for 10 years, mostly because my health kept getting in the way and I couldn't get into the active space. So that's another story. We can go down that road if you want. But yeah, it was a bit of grit and determination and finally got into the active space. We did that. Partnering and taking advantage of opportunities was really the name of the game there.
Okay. How long ago was it since how long have you been in the active space now?
Been in the active space for 4 years, just before COVID. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you've already gone through a lot and seen a lot, especially if you've been on the roller coaster ride up. Now you're probably like seatbelt on and wondering what it's going to potentially look like on the way down. Some people, right, whether or not think it. So in 4 years, you've basically gone from, like I said, zero to almost 100 million under management. Early on getting started, what were some of your fears from going from passive to active, and how did you overcome those fears?
I love that. Yes. I think if people are honest, they will talk about their fears. And I definitely had a whole bunch. Namely, as someone who, I'll be very upfront, I've never even purchased my own single family home. How was I going to purchase a multifamily large apartment complex? And one way I did mitigate that fear was, again, getting that passive experience, but then working on my mindset, to your point, to get into the active space of, I knew I needed to raise capital from folks. Who was going to want to invest with me? And what if, God forbid, all my education experience didn't do justice? God forbid, lost people's money or picked the right apartment complex or didn't know how to manage. So I had a whole slew of fears that thankfully didn't hold me back, but were definitely on my mind as I got started in the active space.
Okay. So first thing that jumps in my mind is, like you mentioned, okay, you bought a single family. Usually when people say that, I tell them they're nuts to go into multifamily property but it always depends on your experience, your background, and many other things. But raising money, you've raised some considerable amount of money. What was your elevator pitch, or when you go to raise money, hey, I have this deal, how did you overcome some of that experience factor? Did you partner with somebody, or what was how'd that work?
That's exactly it. Partnerships are the name of the game in this space. So even as a more experienced and seasoned person on the active side of this space, having partners, I feel, gives such an advantage to my investors, to myself, to the security of the deal, even to our residents. Yes, finding a partner, people that were more experienced than me, that had a track record and knowledge that I could bring my knowledge and experience to, and for us to really just multiply that. So that was a great way where I was able to calm some of my own fears and then also have the confidence to tell people about what I was doing in space and see if it was a good fit for them to passively invest with us.
Yeah. So for those listening, especially a lot of the men out there, get off the ego trip and partner with somebody that has experience, that it's a win-win for both of you. Far too often, people's egos get in the way and, oh, I want to take this on myself, or I can do this myself. And that's a lot of times when people sometimes do get themselves in trouble. You partner with somebody, it can be a huge win-win, give you that experience, give you that advantage. And here is a perfect example we're talking about today of how to do that.
It's a team sport without a doubt, and you can go further faster. I always say, yeah, I think some folks have been able to do this successfully on their own, but their journey is significantly slower. They have more risk, and their risk of getting burned out is significantly higher. I wouldn't say it's a must to partner with people, but again, you can go much further faster if you do.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm yelling at myself a little bit when I made that statement, because as people know, I worked a W-2, I was buying a lot of notes, I was working for basically doing it all by myself. And I got to a point where I couldn't scale any further because I had reached my peak. And then I brought on Lauren and who started working for me part-time and so forth, and then realized, oh, she's got a background in sales and raising money and some other things. And it's, oh my God, like, where have you been like the last 2 years? And now we have a company with 10 employees and we launched it last July with 20 plus million under management right now and keep growing. And like you said, you put the good team together and you get around the right people, the scalability factor is so much faster. So
huge. Oh, congrats to you. That's a great lesson.
So now one of the challenges as we talk about scaling is also make sure you don't scale too fast. What are some of the things as you've grown to basically also, again, put on the brakes to basically, okay, I want to make sure I'm doing this at the right pace?
Gosh, that is such an astute question, and I've never been asked that on a podcast, so thank you for asking. I think there were several aspects to that, because to your point, it can be really sexy and fun to throw out, and we're continuing to grow, and acquisition fees and asset management fees and getting investors and deals. Asset management piece is the most difficult and challenging, I would say, part of this industry. And COVID, now through a potential economic downturn, really making sure that there are eyeballs and people that are paying attention, myself included, but also business partners, property management, really making sure to operate the property. We've intentionally passed up on deals and only purchased really the cream of the crop, the best of the best. We don't have several acquisitions going on at once. It's been a very steady, measured pace. And does that mean we don't have investors knocking down our door saying, Amy, when is the next deal? I've got this capital I need to deploy. Yeah, without a doubt, we've received a little bit of pushback because people really do want to invest, but it is so essential. And we see many examples of folks scaling too quickly. And ultimately, that doesn't serve our investors. And of course, that doesn't serve our tenants, who we really want to make sure get the best care and management possible for where they live.
Yeah, back about 15 years ago now, 2008 crisis, I was working for a company. And at the time, there actually was a large general contractor that was actually buying up a lot of smaller general contractors because a lot of them had cash flow issues or going under. Yes. And what we constantly kept seeing with every one of those contractors was in 2004 and five, they were well-run funded. And then 6 and 7, they took on too much. They added too many people and they scaled too fast. And they didn't have the systems or the approaches or the approach to basically outfit or grow. So yes. I've always carried that with me. And I'm in a mastermind group where a few months ago, we were all getting together and people are pretty open. And it's okay, you know, what's your company worth or your net worth? And where do you want to be by the end of this year?
Yeah.
You know, some people put these very lofty goals out and stuff. And mine actually, I said, I want mine to stay the same. And people look at me like, some people are like, you're nuts. And other people are like, wow, that is awesome. And yeah. My response was, and this was in January, I said, this year is going to be, excuse the phrase, a storm coming. Yeah. It's brewing. And for me, I want to make sure I stay even. I'm not going to try and grow too fast. Yes, I want my company to grow, but overall, I want to make sure we stay stable, because if we stay stable through this thing, when everyone else behind us keeps falling down, then we're going to come right back around to pick up all those pieces. So in 24 months from now, that's when we want to see that growth.
Brilliant. Yeah, we're almost through Q1 of 2023. We haven't acquired a single asset. Doesn't mean we're not looking, but we've intentionally passed up on hundreds and hundreds of deals that we've taken the time to underwrite. It's just the right thing to do. So I agree with you completely. I love that we're like-minded like that.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly, the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you.
You're looking at the deals of some people looking at multifamily deals or people who passively invest in multifamily. What are some nuggets you can give if someone, a passive investor, was going to go look at investing in a syndicator on a multifamily deal? Like I said, interest rates have skyrocketed. Debt has become much more expensive. Cap rates probably might have to make some shifts and stuff. What do you tell your investors when they come to you and they ask those questions? Should I be nervous when you're looking at this type of deal? Or I don't know what I don't know. So what do we need to look for? What are some of the risks?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. First and foremost, and I think you touched on this, is look at the operator. What's their track record? What's their philosophy, their acquisition philosophy? And of course, what are their values, right? Not everyone has the kind of the same perspective of conservatism or how to treat residents. So that's one thing. That's not really economics. But second thing I would advise is look at the market. We all know, I'm in Los Angeles, you're in DC. These are not the same real estate markets, no matter what type of commercial property, not the same as Texas. You mentioned 2008. We look back at Dallas, barely felt anything. And every market felt a little bit, but it's not the same across the board, across all markets. Los Angeles is obviously a more risky place. So choosing the right market and being very strategic and understanding what's the economic base, what's the population growth, even during an economic downturn, can be imperative. And then, of course, then third, I would recommend getting to the property. Some things that I talk about that I look for, and I think my investors appreciate, is, of course, the cost basis. Where are we buying this deal? Is it at a premium? Are we buying below replacement cost? Are we buying at some sort of a discount? So the cost basis is imperative. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the debt that we're putting on the deal, are we in a negative leverage situation? Is our interest rate higher than the cap rate where we're buying? Yeah. Hopefully. And then, of course, what's the business plan? Are we assuming that rents are going to skyrocket once we renovate for the first year? No, we may assume that rents will be flat for the first year or two. Again, just to be conservative, maybe we decide to renovate a little bit instead of renovating the entire complex, test to see how that goes in the market, see if maybe there are economic changes that may prohibit us from pouring all that CapEx and doing that business plan and taking a steady, measured approach. So those are just a few things that I talk about and ask my investors to take a look at as they're making a decision for what's best for them.
No, those are all great comments that you mentioned. And it's, again, that conservative approach, because far too often you see everyone write a pro forma that's best on based off of all the planets aligning or all the stars right. aligning. And if one little hiccup, in perfect example, I've seen, so again, my background, I have a lot of multifamily experience and especially ground up. And people all of a sudden pick an absorption rate, which is how fast you're going to rent the units. And they're like, oh, 300 unit building, we're going to get 20 units a month. This thing's going to be absorbed in 15 months. The absorption rate's really the first 2 or 3 months you hit that because it's a new building. People are like, oh, new building, fear of missing out. But after that, all of a sudden drops down to 10. And it's because maybe your rents were too high, but all of a sudden you drop your rents to get that absorption. Now you had both of them pinned it here. Now one's like this, but then it's that seesaw that you're going back and forth on. And then your lenders are basically wanting to make sure you have a certain amount of reserves. You got to put money in reserves and then you don't meet the DSCR or a lot of impact that can happen along that. And like I mentioned, far too many deals that I've seen come across my desk, because we'll still look at some small multifamily deals for our fund. And they are the rosiest of rosy pictures, I'll tell you. And I love the ones that are like, it's getting 1200, but you can get 1400. And we'll sell it to you for 1400. Why aren't you getting the 1400? And if you go to everyone at 12 and offer them 1400, yeah, some of them might bite. Right. I guarantee you, your vacancy rates are going to skyrocket for 90 days or more. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. So many details that lend layers of conservatism that I think are very prudent right now, or and always, truthfully, best to underpromise and overdeliver, whether it's your own investment you're holding yourself or you're syndicating.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, from a debt structure standpoint within your funds, I'm guessing you'll basically go raise money from some equity investors and then basically give them a specific type of return and the rest you get financed from lenders?
Yeah. Yes. I actually don't have a fund. I do this on a, I syndicate on a deal by deal basis.
Okay.
Yep. So yeah, we present exactly. Yes. We have limited partners. We have investors that choose to invest alongside us. And then yes, we finance the deal as well.
Okay. What percent of financing do you get, just out of curiosity?
It really depends on the business plan. It really, every single deal we've done has been different in terms of leverage, whether it's a loan to value, loan to cost scenario, rate, fixed rate, agency debt, bridge. It really varies.
Okay. Have you seen any seller finance types of properties, or have you gotten involved in trying to strike any deals on any seller finance?
We've come across, asking prices are still pretty high. So obviously it's very attractive right now to be able to assume loans, but there's still a lot of money out there looking for a home and they're still willing to take a bit more risk than we are. So we haven't been competitive.
So you mentioned this year, you haven't bought an asset yet this year. If I picked up the phone and called you a year from now and said, how you doing? Where you at? To put a smile on your face, where what would you tell me?
I would say a year from now, I would anticipate and I'd be very happy if we picked up maybe two, maybe three assets over the next 12 months. Again, I'm in no hurry to jump in, but even if the proverbial poop hit the fan, as you mentioned, and there were deals raining from the sky of unfortunate folks that have needed to sell, I still want to be very prudent and conservative in terms of catching a falling knife, making sure things are in a condition and there's a business plan that'll be appropriate for myself and my investors. I think a handful of assets over the next 12 months would serve us well, but I've never aimed to grow this company at an explosive rate. And I always want my investors to be able to pick up the phone and reach me and not get so big that they're unable to get in contact if they need me. So we'll be slow and steady, really, regardless of the market cycle. I know, I'm so exciting, aren't I?
No, you're probably wondering, man, he comes out with some heart. He's coming at me with some of these questions.
No, so, they're great. I hope I'm hanging there with you.
Oh, absolutely. Quick question. Is it just you, or do you have a team, or what does Silvis Capital look like?
Yeah, to your point, Silvis Capital is myself and my husband. My husband's still at his W-2. He loves what he does. He works at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and mentors and just gets a lot out of it. But he works the business with me. But as I mentioned, I love partnering with people. I think it's a superpower. Some deals, I source deals, bring them to folks, and they bring capital that they have. I'm investor relations for some deals on other people's deals that they bring and that they've been able to source in their local markets. I guess on the face of it, yes, it is my husband and I as Silvis Capital. But in terms of our business partners, the relationships that we have and the sheer force and experience we have behind the investment opportunities, there are many of us with hundreds of years of experience.
And what markets do you like to play in?
So we've been in the Southeast and in the Midwest. Southeast, obviously, a lot of folks have been really interested in that space because of the migration and large economic growth. But we also love Indiana, very underrepresented, I think unpopular state with a great business environment. And then Kansas City, both in Missouri and in Kansas, both sides. Really love those markets and have had recent acquisitions there as well.
Yeah. A lot of people I talk to keep saying the same thing. The Kansas City market has been something that has really been up and coming, and from a great cash flow is what I've heard from that type of market. Yeah. Indiana is the same. Southeast, I think you get a little bit of both and get some equity build along with the cash flow in those markets. Nothing in California?
Shocker. Again, March 17th, 2023. I think yesterday was the 3-year anniversary of the COVID, the national COVID lockdowns. We still have eviction moratoriums in Los Angeles counties. That coupled with a lack of net migration, the growth, and of course, a statewide rent control, just not for me. So I love the expression I actually heard from Dave Lindahl almost a decade ago of live where you want, invest where it makes sense.
No, like I mentioned pre-recording, most of my staff is in California and we'll see some loans or some stuff come into California and certain areas are like, oh, they love. And then there was a loan the other day that I brought up that was in a place that it's, I think in the like the highlands or whatever, it's off the coast, but it's like on the way to Vegas and they're like,
Oh, the high desert.
Yeah, high desert. And they're like, you couldn't pay me to take that loan because if I took that property, I would not want that. And I'm like, man, California's like hit or miss. Of course, it is like the entire size of the East Coast. Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting because being in the debt space, our goal is we really don't want the property. We really don't see a lot in California. Most of the stuff we do see is actually in the Southeast and Midwest as well.
Interesting.
And it's very similar. The Northeast, A, it's expensive, got very long moratoriums for foreclosures, which New York, for example, can take up to 5 years to foreclose on a borrower. Where in Georgia, I file a complaint today, the sale date is going to be that first Tuesday in May. So give you an idea of each state is so very different and similar to like multifamily, making sure you understand and know the rules and have the right team. And what I think is very interesting as well is you bring in these partners and being able to scale with just you and your husband. So you're in so much control. I'm guessing also every deal has like a specific property manager and everything is done. So you're really a true, I'll say you're active, but you're really a passive owner in some sense because you'll buy the asset, you'll act as the owner operator, but then again, you turn it over to a property management firm that handles all of that stuff, correct?
Yeah, but property managers, you're absolutely right. So we're not active on the ground fixing the toilets, getting the midnight calls and all that. But property management definitely does not have the same kind of asset management mindset that we do. And I see folks make that mistake often in the space. So yeah, asset management definitely takes a good amount of my time, especially to do it well. We're not micromanaging, but they don't really have, property management doesn't have as much of an eye towards investor returns and things like that. But yeah, we've been really fortunate with the property management people that we work with. But yeah, it is less active than it would be if we were the people on the ground interacting with the tenants.
How did, again, jumping a little bit back and forth, but you were passive and then you got active and so forth, but tell us how your first deal came together, because the first one's always the hardest of, I don't know really anybody, like what market am I going to choose? How am I partnering? I find a deal that comes to me. Who do I send it to? What do I do? Some people get so excited that somebody actually called them with a deal. Now it's, that's sometimes the easy part. Now, what do I got to do?
Gosh, I know that feeling so well. You articulated that perfectly. I had a great coach at the time that intentionally had me network with business partners that were looking in similar markets and for similar things that I was looking for the first deal. So once I finally found it in just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, I knew exactly who I wanted to partner with. I knew this was the type of deal that they were interested in. We had very like-minded values. So that box was checked. So I think it was a little less kind of chaotic and scary, if I can say that, than it would have been otherwise. I definitely was scared and nervous, and the whole process was quite a learning curve. But yeah, I think to your point, having your ducks in the row to the best of your ability prior to doing that first deal can be really helpful.
So how long was that courtship process of you found somebody you wanted to work with? I know it's just not one phone call of, hey, bring you a deal, let's partner together. But did you fly out to meet with them, or was it all done virtually? I know it was also right around COVID time. How'd that work?
Yes, it was all virtual, if you can believe that. So one thing I didn't mention that I'm very open about, we can talk if you feel like it, is I have cystic fibrosis. It's a lung condition. So as you can imagine, during COVID, I was a bit more hunkered down. And I was actually a little afraid that, oh gosh, I finally found this deal. I finally found these people that it looks like a good business partnership. Now I'm going to have to tell them, hey, I'm pretty isolated and not going to be able to do a lot of things like flying out to the properties. But thankfully, I had passively invested with these folks for over a year. So we had built that relationship. We had the intention of doing a deal together. Yeah, I think passively investing with people you want to do business with is a really underrated strategy.
That is actually genius of, hey, let me give you your money. I'll continue to work with you. I'm an investor, so you still got to answer my calls. And then, hey, if I bring you a deal and they get to know you, wow.
Yeah, it worked out quite nicely. They're amazing folks. Yeah, I was very grateful for that. But yeah, to your point, we already had that existing relationship and they knew about my situation. So not being able to be boots on the ground during due diligence, inspection, and all of that was okay. But yeah, it was a bit more of a challenging situation because of that black swan event than I ever anticipated.
Yeah, and similar with in my situation where I started bringing on staff about a year ago now, and they came on board, and Lauren has been with me for 2 years now. Had never met her in person. Everything's virtual. And then last September, October, we had a company retreat. So I actually got to meet everyone for the first time. There was only one staff member who I had actually met in the past. Wow. And funny enough, it was also, you're going to laugh when you hear this, it was actually my first time to California.
Awesome.
Being on the East Coast, basically for vacations, we'd always go to Florida or the Caribbean or an island and so forth. We didn't really have a need to go to the West Coast. And as kids, we had Disney World on the East Coast. So why didn't we go to California? But
Makes perfect sense. Oh, yeah. But,
no, that is, wow. I'm still like shocked by, oh my God, that seems so simple of, hey, let me invest with somebody and kind of use that as a onboarding process to learn more about it and stuff and then build that relationship and then end up turning it. So I guess my question is, how many companies did you invest with that are now partners?
Just two.
Oh, yeah. Just two? Yeah. Two more than everybody else listening to this podcast is my guess.
Good. Hopefully there'll be more people using the strategy because I think it's such a win-win, right? We always try to figure out ways so everyone on both sides of the table win. Yeah.
No, and that's really the great mindset and kind of what I joked about earlier about like bringing on partners, always got to be that win-win. And as people get started, I had a podcast guest on a month or so ago, and he had a really powerful line that, and this person's done extremely well. Yeah. And was he was getting going, and this is what he tells people now, and it's not meant out of arrogance, but it's all about perspective. And when he was getting started, what he mentioned is, if you're reaching out to somebody and asking them for an information, what is the cost of that information? And the cost of the information is how much time it takes for you or you to research it. Is it something you could have done? And if that person spends 15 minutes with you and they're worth $100 million, think of how much money that is to them, because time is the one thing we can't make more of. And as people get older and as they create more wealth, that's the one thing they focus a lot more on is their time. So realize the importance of that conversation with them, that when you bring it to somebody, make sure it's powerful and impactful. And also if there's a way that you can make it a win-win where you could potentially work with them or do something for them. So that's exactly what you did. So that's awesome.
So smart. I love that because to your point, I think, and I get it, right? All of us want something, but on the other side has a need. So being able to uncover that, finding a way to add value. One of my favorite books is called The Go-Giver by Bob Berg. I don't know if you've read it or anyone else has read it, but it's so powerful. You already exhibit and probably live a lot of those values, Chris, but it's a great recommendation for anyone looking to do that in this space.
So one of the other things you mentioned that a few minutes ago that you mentioned it in passing, but it's also a very important component. A few things is when people get started and going, money's always tight or people try and hold on to things and so forth. But you mentioned you also had a coach.
Yes.
And the importance of a coach. And being around people, whether it's a true mastermind group or a coach or somebody that you can have open conversation with and be a mentor, is so powerful. You want to share a little bit of stories, some things you learned from that?
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. If finding people that are where you want to go. I do hear some people poo-pooing the kind of the gurus in this space, aside from passively investing, which again, you're not hiring a mentor. You're looking over somebody's shoulder, asking some questions. Aside from that, I don't know how you're going to really dive into this space and gain the skills, because I love one of my business partners, Chad Sutton, always says there are the known knowns, the known unknowns, and then the unknown unknowns. Yes. And those will sink you, right? So having a coach or a mentor or being part of a mastermind can really uncover those for you. So it was key for me. It was expensive without a shadow of a doubt, but I really kind of burned the boats behind me type perspective of I'm going to sink in this money, which means I'm going to learn. I am going to succeed. I'm going to get an ROI on this. And failure was simply not an option. Of course, I didn't fail, but it's been really instrumental. I still keep in touch with that coach, even though we don't have a formal coaching relationship. But then it's that further, faster mentality.
Yeah. And I usually tell people who want a coach, or, and you mentioned like the word is gurus. Now, there's a difference between mastermind gurus and coaches. Mastermind to me is a group of people who are all sharing experiences. It's not one person doing all the talking with everyone else less experienced. It's everyone who has different values and mindsets and different experience levels together. A coach is somebody that's, I'd say, continuous. Guru to me is you go for a weekend for $500 and then they say, oh, join my class for $20,000 and it'll last a month.
Yeah.
That is the stuff I would tell people stay away from.
Yeah.
But if there's somebody who has something that's more over a lengthier period of time, that yes, they can be expensive, or whether it's a coach or specific to business or specific to real estate, they can be very valuable. It's just a matter of make sure they're not doing it with 1,000 people, because how much time can spenders? If it smells like a skunk or bad deal, it probably is. But the most important thing about it, which you've done, that I know somebody else could have done the same exact thing you did, but you took, and that's the biggest thing, that a coach can basically give you all the tools, but they can't force you out onto that court to go play the game.
Great point. Yeah, I do. Again, and I think some people get a little upset about how much some coaches cost, but the flip side of it is if you've spent that money and you need to make sure to get an ROI on that money, you must take action despite any fear you have. Yeah, to your point, it doesn't work unless you do. So that's really imperative.
Hey, thank you for coming on this episode, as always. So I always like to ask at the end, any final words of, you've dropped a lot of nuggets for people today. Any lasting thoughts or anything you'd like to share with people as we wrap up? And also make sure to leave people, if someone wanted to contact you, what's the best way to reach out?
Sure. Yeah. I think my final words of wisdom, a quote that I remind myself of almost every day, is everything you want is on the other side of fear. Fear is not an indication that you shouldn't do something, but maybe it's a call to get more information and to still take action anyway. Hopefully that's helpful to someone listening to that. I know it's really helpful to me because I navigate this entrepreneurial journey. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I post every day looking to add value to folks that are interested in learning more about financial freedom and earning passive income in this space. So you can find me. My last name is spelled a little funny, but I know Chris will put that in the bio. And then you can reach out on silvascapital.com. If you throw a /webinar, we've got a free educational training about what we do in this space and how we might be able to serve you.
Great. So thank you, Amy, for joining us today and for everyone listening. And as always, please make sure to like and subscribe on your favorite listening station. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.